In this episode of the Salesforce Posse podcast, I'm going to be talking to Lars Malmquist, who is a certified technical architect working from Denmark. We had a fantastic time discussing Salesforce anti-patterns, but also generative AI from somebody who actually has a deep understanding of AI and Salesforce anti-patterns. In fact, he's written two books on each of those subjects. Lars also talks about the limitations and pitfalls of Salesforce that Salesforce isn't great at teaching, but is really important to know if you're architecting solutions on Salesforce. And we also talk about patterns and anti-patterns and what they are and why they're important to know. He also shares some great anti-patterns like declarative is always safe, which anyone who's worked on the platform for many years knows that this really isn't the case. My name is Francis Pinder, and on the Salesforce Posse podcast, I speak to Salesforce industry influencers so we can gain a better understanding of how to excel in a career path from a Salesforce admin or developer to an architect. So, if you're interested in learning Salesforce anti-patterns, want to learn some top tips on becoming an architect, or things to avoid on a Salesforce implementation, then I think you're going to get a lot of value out of this conversation with Lars. So, without further ado, let's go. So, hello, Lars Malmquist, and welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Francis.
Now, I kind of brought you on the podcast because you're an architect. When I was out in Denmark, because you live and work out in Denmark, and I was out there chatting with different architects out there, and somebody said it was probably a good idea to grab you and get you on the podcast because you've got such a wealth of knowledge. You're Salesforce CTA, I believe.
Yeah, that's right. Yes, that's right.
Yeah. Working for a consultancy, and you've kind of got this massive amount of experience. And also, you've kind of actually just written a new book as well around anti-patterns and patterns, which I'd love to go into, which is a great book too. But before we kind of get started, I'd love to know, like, how did you get into the Salesforce ecosystem initially? And what was your kind of history before?
Yeah, it's a little bit random, actually. So I started as a programmer way back in sort of the tail end of the dot-com boom in the late 90s. I got my first computer when I was 6, and I always programmed. And then, you know, I was an 18-year-old who knew how to do HTML and Perl and stuff like that.
Sounds like me as well, at the end of the dot-com boom.
Yeah.
Hey, anybody who knows HTML?
Exactly. If you know HTML, you know a little bit of JavaScript, you're sorted, right? That's how I started in IT. And then I joined a bunch of consultancies and startups throughout the early noughties and, you know, software development roles, and eventually moved into a development management position. And then I came to the UK, in the UK before going back to Denmark.
Oh, right.
And did an MBA at Cambridge, which was great timing because I did my MBA when I started on the Tuesday after I started, Lehman Brothers collapsed.
Right.
And we had the great financial crisis. So obviously there were no jobs or no nothing. So at the end of that, I sort of, you know, we got into cloud computing as part of that program. We did a research project for HP and BT. And we set up a company to explore this new thing at the time, which was called cloud computing, right? Nobody really knew what it was. It was, you know, people in Silicon Valley was talking about it, but, you know, nobody really understood it at the time. So we figured there's a business opportunity here. We founded a company based on sort of bringing cloud into a public sector setting, actually, initially. Did quite well with that as a consulting offering for a little bit. But then, you know, we actually started developing some products, and, you know, we were a small company and we got introduced to this thing called Salesforce. And there was this thing called the force.com platform. And, we started looking at it and we thought, okay, it's a little bit expensive, but actually look at how fast we can build stuff. Right. And as a startup that was trying to break into quite a difficult market, but a market where the kind of applications you do with Salesforce, sort of process driven, data driven, heavy on reporting, but not necessarily, you know, it doesn't have to be a highly customized user interface or things like that. It's really about the process and the data. you can build those kinds of applications on Salesforce at a speed that's just much, much faster than trying to do it yourself. So we adopted Salesforce as our development platform, and you know, I never looked back from that, right? So we basically...
Yeah, was that then? Was that...
That was in 2009.
Oh, okay, cool. Actually, so similar time that I started as well. It seems like quite a few of us, you know, all started kind of at a similar time into the Salesforce ecosystem. Okay, cool. And so now, spinning forward today, you're working for a consultancy out in Denmark.
Yeah, I'm working for a consultancy. I was with Accenture up until last September, and then I joined this management consultancy called Implement, which is one of the largest management consultancies in the Nordics. And we're sort of trying to build it's a hybrid offering where we take sort of deep Salesforce technical skills and we combine them with the management consulting skills from the commercial guys and the digital transformation guys, and try to target some of the things. Because, I mean, I think like the Salesforce ecosystem is evolving, right? And a lot of the big customers and the big companies, they've already adopted Salesforce. They've been through a number of implementations. They probably have multiple clouds and, you know, they need a different kind of offering. They really need somebody who goes in and who understands the business process, understands how can we really get value from all of these licenses we've bought. And I mean, I think the Salesforce ecosystem has been very focused on just, you know, next thing, next thing, next thing, next thing, right?
Completely, yeah.
So, you know.
It's this kind of like you've got this kind of gravy train of new customers constantly coming. It's quickly get them out. So, yeah.
And that's been really great for many years. But I think the landscape is shifting. And a lot of that is, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's a different game, right? It's not just let's roll out the next cloud. It's also, you know, how do we leverage the investment? Like where do we...
I feel like it's kind of like it's really kind of now stepping up in maturity.
Exactly.
On, you know, really kind of how you maximize its value. How do you really kind of look at the business architecture and the kind of the way the business works to kind of track value and make changes that are kind of worthwhile for the organization? But yeah, there's definitely a just shift having. And also I think, yeah, consultancies and like yourself, you know, they're kind of niching down into certain areas and certain industries and becoming really brilliant at delivering that kind of.
Exactly. At this specific thing. Yeah.
Which I think a lot of people, I keep on getting every time. It's amazing. I get a lot of, probably you as well, a lot of messages through LinkedIn and stuff going, we are a Salesforce consultancy. We have developers and admins. And I always ask, it's like, okay, what do you specialize in? And it's always nothing, right? And it's like, well.
Well, you get a long list saying we have people with certificates across all of these clouds, right? That's what you.
Yeah, exactly. And it's like, yeah, but that's not quite what I'm asking, yeah? Because you are the same as everybody else. Like, how do I differentiate you from somebody else, you know? So
I agree. And I mean, to some extent, this shift has happened in ERP a long time ago, right? You can see SAP, like, there are people who have made a career out of a single module in SAP and just how to adapt that in the right way. And I mean, as Salesforce matures and it becomes a business critical system, right, you know, for a lot of big companies today, effectively, you know, their front office is Salesforce, right? That's, you know, in the same way that SAP might be their back office, you know, there's Salesforce running all of the front office. And that's a critical business function, and it's not something where, you know, you could be as gung ho about it as perhaps it has been very much, you know, let's just put more stuff in, let's put the next thing in. And I think now we need to think about, you know, that's not that there's anything wrong with that, but now we just need to focus in a little bit and say we have this absolutely mission critical system that's running a very important function within the business. How do we give it the serious attention that it requires, right?
Yeah, and also I think you kind of get the clients, I'm working with a client at the moment where, you know, they've had a lot of consultancies and a lot of people working in the org, and that's built up a lot of kind of tech debt and business debt as well on Salesforce. And it's like, how do you go from there, right? And it's not like we're going to stop for the next 6 months and just work on that. You know, that's never going to happen, right?
No, it's never. So you build up tech debt. You also sometimes you build up, you know, adoption debt, right? You end up with.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, yeah, I've got Sales Cloud and I've kind of got my sales guys using it. But really what they do is they log in at the end of Friday afternoon to do their mandatory updates in the CRM because nobody ever really, really got them engaged in using the system in the right way. So there's all of those kinds of things on a lot of options.
And it's so hard to create that account record that I'm actually not even going to put the opportunity in until I know it's actually pretty much, you know, and you can.
I know it's actually pretty much there. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly, which completely loses all the value, right? You know.
Yeah, or, you know, I just forget updating all of the opportunities that I no longer care about because it's too hard. And then eventually data quality drops to a point where it becomes unusable, right?
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
All of that stuff kind of happens, so.
So one of the key things I wanted to pick your brains off on the podcast was around patterns and anti-patterns and the kind of architectural approaches to Salesforce. On what you think kind of key things that are most important, I think, to somebody wanting to become an architect, and what you think those kind of traits and skills should be and should people should kind of focus on in your opinion. Big, long question, I know, but yeah.
That is a big, long question. But I mean, I guess I can sort of start by saying that I actually think one thing that Salesforce does really well is the enablement, right? There is a lot of resources on Salesforce Architects, on Trello and so on, that gives you sort of really good practice and good exemplars that you can follow. And you've got, increasingly we've got reference blueprints, we've got standard types of diagrams so that we can communicate in a consistent way. And actually, you know, learning that really well brings you quite far, right? That gives you a good starting point if you're an aspiring architect, just learning how think about architecture by studying the pre-existing patterns, the reference blueprints, learning how to produce diagrams and descriptions in the way that's expected so that other people understand what you mean. That is a hugely valuable step. And it's something that Salesforce actually enables you to do with a lot of resources. They put a lot of resources to at your disposal. What I perhaps think that, you know, Salesforce has been less good at, and also why I wrote my book. It's not always clear where the limitations are, where the pitfalls are, and where things can go horribly wrong, right? That is, you know, that there is a bit of a positivity bias saying, you know, like follow good practice, follow the blueprints, you know, don't do this, don't do that, and you'll be fine, right? And it doesn't recognize the reality that sometimes things are really hard and you've got stakeholders pushing for completely crazy things. And you've got technical debt and legacy and your developers don't really understand what it is you're trying to tell. And that means that it goes wrong.
And a square peg, round hole, trying to get stuff in. Yeah.
You're trying to use the wrong pattern for the job and all these things. That is perhaps, so that's kind of one of the reasons why I wrote my recent book.
Oh, yeah. Salesforce anti-pattern. So for those who don't know anything about what an anti-pattern is, could you kind of describe what it is?
I can. So, I mean, we all know patterns, right? A pattern is a good solution that you can apply in a context to get a good result, right? So an anti-pattern looks like it's a pattern. It looks like it could be a good solution, but actually it leads to horrible results, right? And I'm going to give sort of my starting example in the book, and one that almost everybody who has worked in IT has experienced, is a classic anti-pattern called Hero, right?
So yeah, I've got the Kindle book, so I'm kind of looking at it now. So
so the Hero anti-pattern is effectively what happens when things have gone wrong and somebody steps up and he says, don't worry, guys. I'll fix it over the weekend. I'll work as hard as it takes to just get it done. I will find some way of doing this and we will still make it on time, right? If that happens once, it's fine, right? If that becomes the way that you solve problems on a program, and often it does, right? Often, basically, the way that you manage to get something across the line is that people basically work excessive hours. They do excessive things. Because that we have some fundamental problems, right? We haven't scoped it correctly. We have late minute requirements that didn't get documented and the business says we can't go live, or, you know, it turns out the data is wrong and we have to do a big remediation exercise at the end of it, or we hit some technical complexity and it actually takes 10 days to do what we thought was going to take one day. All of those things, you know, they happen on projects, right?
And I think, and also a lot of the businesses don't even realize it's happening, right? They don't realize there's these people doing this work, or there's a team of, you know, eight people just trying to get the release sorted, you know.
So it seems like a good idea at the time. It can seem like a really good idea. Let's just power through. Let's just be heroes and get it done. Well, the problem is if that then becomes the way you solve problems, right? What's going to happen? Over time, we've been doing this for a year or two. People are going to get tired. They're going to not have time to document things. We're going to start accumulating technical debt because we're going to cut corners because we know that that we don't have time to do anything. We can't scale it, right? Because you can't scale a hero, right? There's only so much of a hero to go.
And also that hero starts becoming the constraint in the system as well, you know?
Exactly. It becomes a constraint in the system. It becomes a bottleneck and you get a single point of failure, right? That person goes down with stress, becomes sick, decides to take another job. You're in real trouble, right? So basically you have an extremely brittle and fragile system set up if you rely on the hero anti-pattern, right? So it seems when you're in the heat of battle, it seems like the right thing to do, but if you keep doing it, it becomes a real mess organizationally. And that's sort of the essence of an anti-pattern, right? It seems like a good, I think, idea. It seems like I can solve my problem by doing this. But actually, if we scale that out and we keep doing it, it becomes unsustainable.
Yeah, definitely. And actually just kind of going through, because you got a load of different anti-patterns, both.
That's about 40 in the book, yeah.
Yeah. Spaghetti sharing model. Love it.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of anti-patterns, they're across, all platforms, right? So, but there are some that are particular to Salesforce. And spaghetti sharing model is a good example because, any platform can have the spaghetti code, right? You can write really bad code on just about any platform and it's a mess. A spaghetti code just means you look at it and you have no idea what the logic is. You can't follow it. Probably not even the person who wrote it originally can figure out why it does what it does. In Salesforce, you can achieve the same effect by combining all of the different sharing mechanisms, right? And there are 30 odd different ways that you can share records in Salesforce. You look at all of them from, you know, programmatic sharing, manager groups, the standard role hierarchy, and the key, restriction rules and all of that. I mean, what's one of my comments, restriction rules is we have too many sharing already. So unless you're really disciplined in how you set up your sharing model, it is very easy to get to a point where you can have instances where, well, I don't know why I have access to this record. I don't know why that user can access that thing. And actually unpicking that, then, you know, do I query the share table manually and figure out all of the different things? And
so I always find like the manual sharing rules as well is kind of like, it's good and bad, right?
Yeah, exactly.
It's like, yeah, users can share records with anyone, but actually that could just cause chaos, right?
Yes, absolutely. No. So in Salesforce, because there are so many different mechanisms and sometimes sharing requirements are genuinely complex, the way you implement them is extremely important. And you have to be really disciplined about it in the same way that you have to be disciplined about writing code. You have to be disciplined about how you implement sharing rules. This actually, I have another sort of Salesforce anti-pattern, which is called declarative is always safe. That's the assumption that a lot of people have in Salesforce that just because I've done something with declarative tools, it's fine, right? And it's not always, right? You can, like, especially when it comes to sharing or permissions, it's not always fine. It's still, you're doing programming. You might be doing programming with metadata, but it still has real consequence.
It's still the same, yeah. And I think one of the most horrific orgs I have been in is one where it's been 100% declarative. And it's like, there's so many, and it was a time before Process Builder, I suppose. So it was a while ago. But there was just hundreds of workflow rules and different things patched on other things and fields to get round other fields and sharing data across. And it was an utter mess. And nobody really knew what changes could react to other kind of workflows and things happening within the system. And it was just chaos. And I always think of, it's kind of like that happy balance, isn't it, between the different process tools and declarative versus code and finding that, you know, that balance.
Yeah, I have another Salesforce anti-pattern for that. It's called Automation Bonanza, which is basically if you don't control the way that you do automations on objects and things, then that's what you end up with. You end up with things just bouncing off each other and nobody being able to trace the line through. And it's an awful lot of it comes down to how you do technical governance and what sort of disciplines you have around implementation, right? I think, again, this is the two-edged sword that is Salesforce, right? Because a lot of things are very easy. Sometimes things are done without the appropriate understanding of the consequences and the appropriate technical governance around it.
But it's easy, right?
Yeah, it's easy to do. It's not necessarily easy to get out of, right?
And I think also this is putting a bit of the curse of Salesforce almost, where you've got all these people that anybody could build on Salesforce. And now as these projects are getting, you know, more mature and people are using it, and this is now their critical system, this has become their critical system over the 5 years, 10 years they've been using it. When you're now at this critical mass where you've got to start thinking about this and making sure you're paying down the debt, but also managing it going forwards and have the governance processes there to get you out of that hole and start doing things in a better way.
No, exactly. And that sort of comes back to the discussion we were having before about how the ecosystem has been evolving, right?
And I think that's where the skill, you know, having those skills really just future-proofs you as well for the future, where you're not just that kind of functional, I kind of think of it as, this functional developer, admin, whatever it be, where you functionally know how it works. Great. Somebody tells you to do it, you do it. And you're moving up that to actually understanding what actually the reasons why you shouldn't do things. And going down that architect route, basically.
Yeah. And I mean, that is, to be honest, that is one of the absolutely core skill sets of becoming an architect, is being able to make that trade-off, right? Because, you know,
it's knowing all the options and coming up with that least worst problem solution. Yeah.
And that's exactly right. It's the least worst option. That's what architecture is about, right? Because, you know, despite what Salesforce might tell you, there is no silver bullet. There is nothing that is just going to solve all your problems, right? There are trade-offs in every technical decision, and you are going to be trading off different concerns in order to make a decision that works for your for the organization that you're implementing for at a given point in time. And, you know, the difference between a good architecture and a bad architecture is simply how well you make those trade-offs, right? At the end of the day. So again, that's why I think the anti-patterns angle is quite interesting here, because yeah, you can learn a lot from, you know, what's the right way of doing it, what's the best practice. However, you know, you're not always in a best practice situation. You're not always in a situation that matches the happy path, right? So when you come off the happy path, when you've got real issues, you also need to be able to figure out, well, I am in a situation where actually there is a lot of technical debt. There is a lot of complexity. We've got stakeholders that are asking for things that aren't really a good fit for what we have. You know, how can I manage that complexity in a way where I still make progress? I still give the user something that they can work with, but I don't leave the org in a worse state than I found it, right? Well, how can I do that while also keeping the technical environment clean, improving on technical debt?
But also you kind of got your futurist hat on as well, making sure that you're not going down a path that's going to be problematic in the future.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean,
the multi hats of an architect.
No, there are quite a few, right? And there are even more now. Again, back to the ecosystem is changing, right? Increasingly, your job is not let's design the best solution for new requirement X. It is let's try to see how we can evolve the system that we already have in ways where we improve on the technical base and also give new valuable functionality and allow users to make use of all of the innovations that are coming from new releases and things like that. So that in and of itself is, you know, managing that process is actually becoming increasingly important relative to the classical design skills that I think probably we focused a lot on in the past.
And as you said earlier, you know, the tools that Salesforce give, I use Lucid Chart like all the time and the diagrams
and they're brilliant. Like they are really good.
But it's also, you know, actually, I think they just released something just recently, B2B commerce diagram, the kind of business value drivers and how that links into certain industries and things like that. And I use that a lot. You know, it's kind of like, well, what are the goals of the organization? How does that link to the business value drivers? And what KPIs are we measuring from that? And how does that link to the capabilities of the platform and stuff outside of it as well?
Yeah, and all of the industry blueprints that they're realizing now, we use those a lot in communicating with clients about how to best leverage the capabilities of the platform and things like that. And it is important, right? Explaining the options well to a business audience is definitely also a critical architecture skill.
And knowing, the level of the people that are in the room that you're talking to and talking in their language and understanding that, you know, if you're in C-level execs, you know, they don't care about the technology at all, right? It's absolutely zero. It's even pointless talking about Salesforce almost. You know, it's just, we want to increase our win rate. How are you going to do it? You know?
Yeah, I actually tried that recently. We did an entire demo not mentioning the name of any Salesforce feature cloud or even that it was Salesforce we were demoing. It's doable. It can be done.
It's doable. Yeah, I know. Absolutely. It's like in some of the discovery workshops we work on, it's like, yeah, you know, mention Salesforce in them because it's not a discovery if you're talking about Salesforce, really. You know, it's fun.
It is.
Yeah, so another thing I want to talk about, because you're kind of in the AI space as well. And actually, that was your first book that you kind of came out with. And ChatGPT-4 has just come out. And I just wondered what you thought about that kind of space, as well as Einstein GPT as well, and how that kind of fits, or how you see that fitting in the ecosystem.
Yeah, so if we're looking at generative AI, it's got just enormous potential in a number of different areas, right? So you've already seen it, you know, do things like it can read Salesforce metadata and explain it to you, or generate, you know, like I've used it to generate like just random test objects. You can obviously do your Apex code, generate test classes from your existing Apex code and stuff like that. Obviously, if you're looking at some of the Einstein GPT use cases, you know, like helping salespeople write targeted emails, figuring out.
Yeah, based on the data or based on the industry or whatever. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And all of that. And it's it has huge potential. I would be a little bit cautious about going too far in the productionizing it right now. It's kind of more of it's more in the potential space, and simply because I think most people are aware that it just makes stuff up, right? It's
limited to the knowledge it's already got, right, on the internet. Or yeah,
and if it doesn't have the knowledge and you ask it for something it doesn't know about, it will just make it up, right? It has this tendency to hallucinate, as it's called, and it keeps getting a little bit better every time. But it's really useful as a supplement if you already know what you're doing. But if you don't know what you're doing, or if you're using it to replace your own intelligence, it's really dangerous because it actually just will make stuff up that is not correct, right? So if I'm a sales guy and I, like, if I were to say automate all of my sales outreach with Einstein GPT, right? Let's say that I want to no longer have my salespeople do outreach. I'm just going to have the AI do outreach. I am going to get scenarios where it has just invented entire conversations that I've had with the customer, and the customer is going to return and say, I never said that. I never asked for that. Why are you talking to me about these things?
Or the other way around, where it's promised something that, you know.
Yeah, or it has promised the customer something that is completely impossible to deliver, also entirely possible, right? So it may get better over time in that effect, but right now I would see it as a supplement, right? So if I'm a sales guy and I know my customer well, and I want to write an outreach email more quickly, then, you know, using AI to generate some options, generate a draft that I then edit and put together and send out, that can actually be, you know, it could be a good use case that increases productivity a little bit. If I'm an admin and I need to adapt some metadata manually because I want to do something very specific, then, you know, asking ChatGPT to help me with that, also perfectly valid. If I have some legacy code and I don't have unit tests for it, generating unit tests for it, as long as I have somebody who actually can understand those unit tests and make sure that it hasn't done something crazy, you know, that will also be helpful, right? So it's sort of, like, in my estimation right now, where it is, you know, it's a productivity boost for people who are already good at their jobs, right?
Yeah, completely. And I think this is one of the reasons why Salesforce has kind of banned it from, like, the community forums and things like this, because also you've kind of got this extra dimension of time as well. So it's sourcing all this information, and what was correct in this or the last release may not be correct in this release, you know? And so, yeah, you kind of get, and I've seen it already. No, that's wrong. Or even this codes examples or snippets where you're like, well, actually, you're putting DML in a for loop there. You know, that's got to be wrong.
It's got to be wrong. And I mean, I to be honest, I've used it to generate some Python code. And sometimes it has just invented entire libraries that don't exist in order to do a task. So, you know.
Brilliant.
Yeah, thanks. I wish that library was there. Unfortunately, it didn't.
I wish that it did exist, but unfortunately.
So, you know, I mean, obviously I knew that and I could fix that, and then I could ask for something else. And, you know, that's also times where you ask for something and it just does it and it's fine, right? You know, I had a, I had a list of URLs that I wanted to turn into a JavaScript array because I needed to use it in some code. Like I just, you know, I put in the list of URLs, said, can you format this as a JavaScript, as a JSON array? And yeah, out it came. That went, that saved me like 5 minutes of manually going through and doing it.
Right? Yeah. So it's going to be a kind of a little productivity gains and stuff. So, cause also there's a lot of talk that it's going to replace kind of Google and search engines as well.
Yeah, but not before it stops doing, like, not before it stops hallucinating, right?
Right, yeah, exactly, yeah. But then that's the danger, isn't it? Because people assume that it's correct and that they don't know it's hallucinating, and therefore, you know, you're going down a path.
You can see that that's what happened, obviously, when Google did their demo of their Bard AI, which is their competitor to ChatGPT. Like, there were some errors in the demo that they were doing, and that made their stock price drop by, you know, 40 billion.
Exactly, yeah.
So it was it didn't do anything that ChatGPT doesn't do. Like if you try the same on the Bing version with ChatGPT, it does the exact same thing.
And actually, in fact, in the last podcast, I was talking and I can't remember what it was now, but yeah, it was kind of like he tried to get it to make moral decisions. And so, you know, the driving down a car and there's somebody in the road or somebody on the street, which way do you go? Or you're going to injure the people in the car or injure the people, which do you pick? And it said, you know, it wouldn't make that moral choice, right? But then he swapped the people for eggs and it would, right? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there's a whole adversarial literature on how you get it to, you know, give you the recipe for creating nuclear bombs and stuff. Like it's,
Exactly, yeah.
like there are ways.
Jolly Roger cookbook from back in the day.
Yeah. So you can also trick it, right? You can trick its safety mechanisms relatively easily. Like this, again, they've released the model.
But then that will mature over time, right? So I think
that it will. And I mean, again, like the model, like the ChatGPT 4 is, they say it's about 40% better at the hallucinating than the old version, and that it's a lot safer, a lot less likely to give into these adversarial responses, at least on their internal tests. So, you know, it's like, I think people were expecting something revolutionary from, you know, ChatGPT 3 to the version that came out yesterday. From what I've been playing around with yesterday and today, it's better. But it's incrementally better, right? It's not it's a step up, but it's not a radical step change. But it is better, and if it keeps getting better at that rate, then you know it'll be interesting to see where it lands. Then it could get to a point where it is really, you know, really powerful, right? Right now, I think there are some powerful applications. I think it's a productivity boost, but I don't think it's quite at the point where it's going to replace a lot of people's day job.
Yeah. And also quite interested in the actual model of where it's come from as well, because it's very much academic driven, right? And all of these different providers. And a lot of those academics have said, hey, based on working on this, you're letting me publish research papers and things like this to making it more kind of democratic. And rather than it's just one company that's owning this tech, which I think is can be quite interesting in the future. And even, yeah.
I mean, there are some really cool open source initiatives that are trying to replicate this, right? So Lion, the company that did the Stable Diffusion model, which is the open source generative art. So all of the, you know, the AI art generator. So they're trying to recreate a version of ChatGPT that's open source. Some other people are trying to sort of do basically distributed training where they can train across the internet to sort of match the scale of training that are done in the big data centers and things like that. So the constraint here isn't actually the technology, right? It's open. Like it is in papers. You can read how it's done. It's not even that complicated. So training these models, like the reason why there isn't an open source model right now is because it's very expensive to train them, right? It requires an awful lot of hardware running for a long time. And that requires a big company to fund it. Or a different model where you find a way of distributing it across enough people, right? And that's what people are working on now. And if they succeed in doing that in a way where we can train in a distributed way across, you know, millions of people on the internet, then there is no particular reason why this should be confined to, you know, Google and Microsoft and the like. So it is interesting.
Cool. Okay. So is there anything else you want to talk about on the podcast before I ask the final question?
I think that's sounds like we've had a good discussion, I think.
Yeah, cool. I think the first thing is that you've got two books, the Salesforce Anti-Patterns that's out now, as well as the AI bot book. But my final question I kind of generally ask everybody is, if you could wind the clock back to a point in time in your past and give yourself some advice, what would the advice be? At what point in time would it be?
It's a good question. I would probably go back to sort of my early career, right? And sort of my early 20s. And I would tell myself that you don't need to know everything right now, right? Because when I was younger, I was just, I felt like I had to be a specialist on everything. I felt like I had to have the answers for all of the questions whenever anybody said anything, and that's, it was one, terribly stressful. It was also terribly counterproductive because you can't be, right? It's actually more important to develop some peak competencies in a few things. And then, over time, as you work on things, you get a lot of, you get the breadth, you get the overview, and you learn what things are more important. So I think I wasted an awful lot of time feeling like I needed to know every little detail about everything and have it present in my head. And, that was a bit of a waste of time. There are better learning strategies out there.
Then you end up forgetting more than you've learned anyway,
Absolutely.
Trying to learn everything, yeah.
So that is probably the advice, yeah. And again, I you see it a lot with people starting out in the Salesforce ecosystem.
Yeah, try and get as many badges as possible.
As many badges as possible. I want to know everything. I want to memorize the entire best practice and all of the limits and stuff like that. It's not necessary, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's much more important to be able to talk and create diagrams and communicate well than it is,
Yeah. And of course you need some hard skills, but it's about getting that balance right.
Yeah, exactly. So, well, thanks so much for being on the podcast. I hope you enjoyed it.
Thanks for having me.
No, I did. And until the next one, thanks so much. Thanks for watching or listening to the Salesforce Posse podcast. Now, please, if you like or what you see or hear, then please rate this podcast in your podcast player, as it tells me that there are people out there that actually are listening to this and that it's useful to them. Also, it helps the podcast algorithms to kind of elevate the podcast in the different podcast directories, which will be really helpful for me as well. And finally, if you do have a question that you want to ask on the podcast, then head to salesforceposse.com/message and maybe you'll appear in the next podcast. But apart from that, thanks for listening, and until next time, ta-ta!